You can now get the episodes on the YouTube channel. Go to youtube.com/I'd Hit That. Subscribe. Get all the new episodes over on YouTube if that's your preferred method. Support the show. Patreon.com/IHTPod. Whatever you can give a month. Get access to the back catalog. Episodes 1 through 147. It's a pretty cool deal. Gotta say, it helps support the show. Get merch. IHTPod.com. Get your coffee mug. Get your t-shirt. Get your hoodie. All of these things are cool. Follow us on Instagram. On X, IHTPod, that's the username. You can donate money, old school, through PayPal. I'd Hit That Podcast@gmail.com. I'd Hit That Podcast@gmail.com through PayPal. Give as much as you can. Donate whatever you think this show's been worth to you. I'll keep creating the content. I live in Texas. I'll go back to Nashville, back to LA, back to New York. Let's keep doing this. With your support, I'll keep pumping them out. Thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting. Enjoy the episode. I want to say your name right the way. Is it Morrow?
Yeah, Morrow, like tomorrow.
That's what I thought, but I just, because, you know, could, yeah, anyway, well.
I've answered to worse.
I understand. I'm in Nashville with Greg Morrow.
Hey.
Great to have you here, man.
Thank you.
Thank you so much on this extremely hot morning already. It's
boy, ain't it.
Going to be 98 today, folks, in Nashville. Greg Morrow. I was just talking to you about the pronunciation of your name. Morrow? Is that another way?
They say it any number of ways, but yeah, I get marrow a lot, you know, because I think it's like bone marrow, but no, it's not an A, it's an O.
Yeah, yeah.
But so anytime someone looks puzzled, I just say it's Morrow, like tomorrow.
Yeah.
And they go, oh, I get it, Tom Morrow.
Right.
Because my given first name is Thomas, but.
So it's actually TG? Is it Thomas Gregory?
Yeah, Thomas Gregory. Yeah.
Okay, why did you go by Greg?
Because my mom said to.
Mom says so.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's they determined that, you know.
Right.
My mom and dad.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Right.
It's okay.
By the way, you were just saying before we rolled tape, you did a gig last night with a bunch of New York guys.
I did, yeah. It was two Rubes and a bunch of Yankees.
I love it.
It was me, Audley Freed and I. We were the Rubes.
Oh, Audley Freed. Yeah, yeah,
Audley
yeah.
was there. He's the one that kind of told him to call me to be the second drummer on this thing. And so it was like a bunch of Yankees and two Rubes.
Love it. Love it.
It was fun. We had a good time.
Yeah. What was the thing again? You were doing a lot of...
It was Peter Levin, who's one of the four that I had never met before, but anyway, he called and he had this thing going. They were going to do this gig that was celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Watkins Glen, you know, festival thing from back in the day. It's kind of famous, infamous kind of show that was the band and the Allman Brothers and the Grateful Dead, and so, you know, two of the three of those bands had two drummers, so he wanted to do two drummers, and you know, that's always an intriguing prospect because it's something that you really don't do a whole lot of these days. But Eric Kalb was the other drummer, and you know, it's one of those things, the moment of truth comes and you know, you count a song off and then you see where the pocket lands, and fortunately for us, we kind of felt it the exact same place. And so it was not even remotely a struggle. It was really fun.
Yeah, because there was no rehearsal, I take it.
We rehearsed the afternoon of the first show in the venue. So,
like during sound check?
Pretty much. It was like a 4.5 hour sound check. And oh, then we, so. And then we played the gig.
Okay, so you did have rehearsal. Okay.
Well, yeah.
And you got to feel it out a little bit, that double drumming thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Did you just have any discussion of who's going to kind of lead? Is it rhythm drums and who does?
Well, no, just in very vague terms, the most obvious thing that, was, when, you know, in the Allman Brothers, that was a much more... Those two roles, the J-Mo Butch roles, were pretty defined. You know, you could really tell who was doing what. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we UB Butch, I'd be J-Mo, or whichever.
You know. What I was going to say. So yeah. How did that go down? Who was Butch, who was J-Mo?
I was more J-Mo, he was more Butch.
Okay, I got it.
Yeah.
I got it. So that's actually a good way to do it, yeah.
And the really fun one, as it turns out, was we did Whip and Post, and the fun one of that is the Butch role's playing kind of halftime, and the J-Mo's, so it's like a full-time under a halftime, so it's big push-pull freight train thing. It's really fun.
Now that is using the double drummer thing.
Oh, yeah, and they did, you know, they were very complimentary of each other's styles, you know. They knew their roles, I guess, as you'd say.
Yeah, because obviously you had studied that enough. Like, you understood all that.
Oh, Fillmore, for a while, when I was, you know, a young fella in high school and all that stuff. Fillmore, you go through these stages where you obsess about something, and every night for, you know, some number of weeks, I would go to bed with my headphones on, listening to one side or the other of Fillmore. You know, it's just what you did.
So those were your guys early on.
Well, they were certainly two of them. That record was pretty formative for me. That Fillmore East record.
Who else were some of your guys back then in the early days? I mean, young man.
Well, you know, the obvious ones are Ringo, yeah, and Charlie Watts. And oddly enough, who I thought was Dave Clark was not.
Right.
It was Bobby Graham,
right,
mostly.
Yeah, yeah.
And as it turns out, you know, he was also in the Kinks. And
That's right.
Unlike what we go through here, session player wise.
Yeah.
You know, it's all okay.
Yeah.
But you listen now and you go, oh, no, yeah, that absolutely was not Dave Clark, you know, because he did play on some stuff, and you can kind of tell when he played and when Bobby Graham played, you know.
Right, right.
It was very different.
So good. Then it's like,
really good. Really,
that's
good.
Bobby, yeah.
All that stuff, you know, that stuff was the, and even just a little bit before that, before I even knew, you know, names or anything, I being from Memphis, little Sun 45s were everywhere, because they just throw them in the back of a trunk and go set up a rack in a dime store or a drug store or anything like that, and just shove it full of Sun 45s of whatever they had, you know. And so Jerry Lee Lewis and Billy Lee Riley and, you know, a lot of that early Sun stuff, it was J.M. Van Eaton, obviously. And he was a wild card, man. He wasn't old as nothing. He was, I still think, a late teenager when he cut a lot of that. It's a whole lot of shaking and stuff like that. And it's just, you know, full of fire and spirit and abandon and, you know, all those things that when you're a kid, you go, oh my God, well, you know, something's working your monkey nerve and you don't really know what it is. It's that energy, you know. So there was that. And all that kind of came from my dad's little brother. He was a teenager when I was born, and he had a little stack of 78s, you know, Little Richard and Fats Domino and stuff like that, which was a little bit unusual in the small town they were from. I still don't really know where he got them.
Right, right.
But he did. He had them.
And you had access to that.
Yeah. That was some of the very first stuff I heard, you know, a Little Richard 78, Ready Teddy and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it was, you know,
I hear you knocking, but you can't.
Yeah, he had that one too, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Did you recognize it when you heard Bonham do Rock and Roll? Like, did you know you're doing Little Richard or no?
Well, at the time, I didn't, because the way he phrased the accents, it was not a direct rip. His accent pattern, it took me a long time to identify where his downbeat was.
Yeah.
And you know,
yeah,
because I always, well, anyway, regardless of whatever, I always misidentified where the downbeat was for a long time, you know. But when Black Dog came out, or when that album, the 4, came out with Rock and Roll on it, that was 73? Was it 73? So it was very early 70, maybe 71. I was only 13, you know. So, you know, you're still figuring stuff. You know, you don't really know, is it this or is it
that? Sure, of course,
You work it out the best you can. And but, yeah, once the light bulb came on, I was like, oh, of course, you know, that's what that is.
But you like Bonham.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was really, you know, an innovator is in terms of heavy drumming, mm-hmm. you know, but still having some feel involved in it, you know.
Of course.
But along with that, see, Donnie Brewer.
Oh, yeah.
Was
Grand Funk.
To me, he was like the Bonham, America's Bonham, because he was a heavy drummer. He was a very heavy drummer, but he had really good time, and he wrote and he sang. I mean, he wrote probably the biggest single they ever had and sang it. We're an American Band.
True.
It's his song, his vocal, you know. And he still plays his butt off.
You ever meet him?
Yeah, I did.
And
in the most odd of circumstances, he for years played with Bob Seger. And because Craig Frost, who was in Grand Funk, Donnie got Craig and Grand Funk, and then Craig got Donnie in Seeger's band. So it's kind of one of those funny
I totally forgot he played with Seeger.
Yeah, he did for a long time. And I don't know exactly what went on or went down or whatever, but I got a call from Seeger's management one day asking if I thought I might be interested in maybe coming up playing a little bit and maybe doing some gigs. And I said, well, yeah, of course. Yeah. yeah. And, you know, and I had a couple of friends in that band that were from here. Some of the guys are based here. And went up and played. And, you know, next thing I know, they're talking tour and all this stuff. And I knew Donnie had been playing. And I never really asked. You know, it was none of my business what the deal was. But as it turns out, on some of those shows, Grand Funk opened for us. And I'm like, wow, this is really weird. I'm in Donnie's chair, you know, playing a gig he's been playing for 25 years. And he's here playing too. I'm
going, opening.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean,
okay.
From a technical standpoint.
It is what it is. No, I know. And that's one of your heroes.
Oh, yeah. And I was, as I have gotten older, it has been kind of a thing of mine to let people know if they were what they meant to me on some level. You know what I'm saying? People that were special to me,
yeah.
and I consider helped me along by studying what they did and loving what they did and finding inspiration there. It doesn't really matter to me if they care or not. I want to tell them.
Did you get that vibe with him? That he, as if he didn't care? Or?
I think he was... No, I think he did... I think he was a bit amused by it. Like, that's great, but you're here, you know, here you are playing this stuff. You know what I'm saying? I think he
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like he appreciated the sentiment, and he was very kind to me. He was very nice and, you know, let me fanboy him and
yeah.
all that stuff.
It's nice to hear that, like, you fanboyed. That's what I'm saying. That's also very heartwarming. You know, you can turn into fanboy.
Well, sure you can.
I think that's great, man. Yeah. I love it. I love it.
I mean, when people are formative in your life,
yeah.
you know, it doesn't hurt anything to let them know that.
Absolutely. Now, by the way, speaking of that, have you ever had experience where you've gotten to meet a hero, an idol, and it just didn't go as you'd hoped? And
yeah, but that's a lesson too.
I'm just saying. Right. So it's happened, right? It has.
Yeah, it has.
There's disappointments.
You know, I don't let it disappoint me. I'm just like, okay. You know, that's another way to see it, you know.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's not.
Of course. I mean, I'm not going to have to name names, although I've said it before. Robbie Robertson, put my hand out, just want to say thank you. I mean, he just looked at my hand and walked. I was at mid-sentence, walked away. You know, it's going to happen, I guess, certain people. You don't have to name names, but I'm saying, like, you've experienced this. I would imagine just artists who they maybe they don't know who you are.
It's more that side of thing than what you would say a peer. In other words, someone who does what you do.
Yes.
You know, another drummer or something. I don't know that I've ever gotten that from
a drummer.
From other drummers.
Because the drummers are the coolest and they just are.
Well, you know, they generally are fairly grounded people.
Yeah.
And accepting of, you know, of the role of...
You know,
you're always on the back line unless you're Levon or somebody
sure.
You know, it's a support based role, but it's really important. You know, if you get up there and muck things up or sort of like, yeah, well, I'm just going to stop. Y'all try rocking now.
Right.
You know, see if you can rock now while I stop.
But at the same time, in other words, you could look at the guitar players and the bass players and keys players as a support role as well. And I guess it's that idea of, like, drummers are such a great bond and brotherhood. And, like, I'm going to ask you, I mean, you've been around longer. I mean, the idea of, do you see guitar players having that kind of brotherhood? It's different, isn't it?
It is different because, you know, it's almost like the old blues guy head cutting thing. They all say, yeah, hey, man. Yeah, great to meet you. Yeah,
he's got very suspicious eyes. Yeah. He's put on the suspicious look up and down. Yeah, who are you? What do you got?
Hey, bro. Yeah. Oh, nice axe.
Right. Well, it's the old, like, it's like the light bulb guitar player joke, right? You know.
Yeah. How many guitar players does it take to change a light bulb? Yeah. The one got to do it and 20 to say, I could have done that.
Thank you. And that's real, right? I mean, again, in your experience, right? Like, do bass players have bass player hangs? And do they have a brotherhood?
Oddly enough, there's a little pack of them around here that kind of is kind of spearheaded by Dave Pomeroy, who's become the local union president. But he used to do this thing around the holidays every year, the Nashville Bass Orchestra. And it was just literally, he would invite any bass player that would come to this club and they would do this stuff. I don't even know what it was.
Secret bass stuff.
I think I would always make sure I was out of town when it happened. So
no drummers around, just bass.
If there was a drummer, I pity him.
Rousing rendition of Big Bottom. Yeah, I love it. I love it.
So there's that. But
yeah. Yeah. No, okay, it is a different thing. So let's jump right into something I've been asking. For you, what makes a great producer?
The first thing is someone who's willing to just let you go out there and take a pass or two and see what you come up with. A lot, you know, most, any good producer is going to have in his mind what he thinks the approach should be. But I think the really, I don't want to say smart ones because that implies that some of them are dumb, and it's not a matter of dumb, but the ones that I think are the most fun to work for are the ones that'll just give you a shot, you know, a time or two and see what your instinct is on something, you know, rather than immediately tell you, you know, unless it's just some kind of ridiculous time crunch where he knows he's got to get it in 20 minutes, you know, and he knows I want this, I want this, I want this, and we got 20 minutes. Yeah. Then it's like, okay, gotcha. You know, I'll do that. But, you know, someone who's willing to at least give something a chance to evolve, you know, I think that's the big thing. And, you know, just, being personable and not being, you know, a hyper kind of domineering personality, that's never really fun. You know, when you got someone just, you know, browbeating you at every turn. And there, you know, there are guys that have that propensity, you know, some of them.
You still see that?
More rarely now. because the competition is so great in that world, because so much happens now in pre-production with track, you know, builder guys, and you know, they wind up exercising a lot of control over where something goes by, you know, their level of programming before you even get the song on the floor. You know, it's a different thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, I'm going to open a can of verse one, then I'm going to open a little can of the chorus and put that there, and then I'm going to open another can of the bridge, and it's all the same cans in the shelf, you know.
He's right.
Pulling them off the shelf and opening them.
So to go back to it, give the guys a chance. Give you a chance to take a pass, your idea, what you hear, what you think it should be, and then...
Yeah, I think that.
Does it sometimes happen where, and they say to you, "Hey, man, you know, I really did have this other thing in my head, but you did it. Like that's it. Like, is that something?"
Occasionally, you get the I would have never thought of that. Occasionally, you do. You know, it's worth a shot. You never know.
And then sometimes it's like, "Hey, that was great, man. That was great. Can we try?"
Yeah, exactly.
Look at that kind of thing, right? Yeah, yeah.
And you say, "Yes, sir. Let's go."
Right, right. And have you seen guys who become, I don't know, like the new hotshot around town because they get some hits out, and all of a sudden they change their entire approach and attitude? Like they all of a sudden think they know best. Have you seen that before?
That's hard to say, especially from this chair, because we're never there with another guy. You know, so if you do see that, it's out in the periphery somewhere in other scenarios. You know what I mean? Like I don't ever see another drummer on the date.
Oh, I meant that another producer.
Oh, a producer.
Like who has a new couple of hits under his belt. He's a big shot now. And you've watched him go from, you know what I mean, that kind of thing where you've seen a guy and you're like, man, this guy's got this gone to his head. Now he's just...
In varying levels, those things can happen. I don't know that I've ever really seen someone just get unbearable.
Okay.
You know, that I'm aware of. But I don't let that stuff register, really. You know, because it doesn't affect me.
Well, when did that click for you? In other words, I get it. Maybe there's a sense of detachment. You're able to go in, clock in, do your gig, and just check out and be like, "Hey, man, that's not my problem." You know, that kind of stuff. When were you able to tap into that attitude?
Really quickly. Yeah, really quickly. And that's, to me, what spawned that was, is realizing that really I'm on my own. I do work for these people, but this is the definition of self-employment. You know, No one is an agent for me. No one solicits for me. You know, it's strictly a performance-based. Someone hears something they like in what I do, and they call me for something. And so my outlook is when I show up, I'm going to bring everything I can and really try to just serve what I'm there to do and try to leave knowing I did that. And then that's the end of that.
Everything else is just, it's not my problem.
Well, I'm not going to let it sour anything.
Right.
I don't want it to sour the next time I come in for somebody, you know? So you just, you walk away from it and start again fresh.
Yeah. Do things feel much different now for you?
Well, yeah. For a number of levels. A number of reasons on a number of levels. I moved here really a little bit late in life to do, you know, to try to be a part of this community and work, you know, in the studio. I was 38 when I moved here, which is funny because people think I've been here as long as Eddie Bears and all that stuff, you know, because I just turned 65. You know, I'm as old as those guys. They just assume I've been here all that same amount of time, but I didn't come here until 96. And you know, fortunately for me, there were some things that some opportunities that worked out really well and kind of got me going fairly quickly. And then you're in your zone. You're in your whatever that lifespan of a top tier session guy is, the clock's running from there. And that doesn't necessarily mean there's a time where it absolutely just goes away and you never do another session. But there is a span, because along with you, there are the producers you're working for, and they have a lifespan too, you know. And then a younger crop comes in, and they have guys that they've worked with and are coming up with. And so there's, you know, for lack of a better term, it's shift change, you know. And that just happens. It was the same way for the guys, you know, before the guys I worked with. You know, there was a shift change for those guys. And at that point, your involvement is really just kind of how much you try to remain viable as a choice. And so, yeah, for me, you know, I'm obviously on one slope of that thing, because I'm not necessarily doing, you know, many of the brand new artists and stuff like that, you know, and that's fine. Someone is, you know, and it's their time. But I still work a good bit, you know, a lot. And, I'm fortunate that I came up with guys that I learned a lot from, not just in playing, but in the technical aspects of stuff. So I do a lot of recording at home, you know, that I enjoy. I've always had a studio since I was a late teenager, very early 20s. So I have that background of being able to knob jockey just enough to function. And I've always enjoyed that. So it's worked out well that the new paradigm shift of, hey, I'm going to send you a click and an acoustic guitar and a vocal. Can you put me a drum track on it? Yeah, I can. You know, and I do that. I go upstairs and turn my stuff on and, you know, get a Coca-Cola and go to town. And it's fun. I enjoy it. I really enjoy that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I never stopped playing live from the time I moved here. I was always involved in one thing or the other to play gigs, because there's just a different energy to that. There's nothing really kind of like that. A good gig and people, that immediate response and all that stuff. So that, you know, that's a little more my focus these days is I go out and I've been playing with Brooks and Dunn lately, and a good little bit with Joe Bonamassa in previous years, and Trisha Yearwood, and I've played with Amy Grant a long time, actually.
Yeah, that's like your longest, no?
Well, it's one of my longest relationships, because I think the first thing I ever did with her was maybe 1980. And, you know, she was like 18 or 19, and I was 21
right.
or something. And so that, you know, that's when we met, and the band I was in at the time had been hired to back her up on a live recording. She had never had a band before, and they wanted to do a live album. They needed a band. So they hired our band to be her band to do these recordings. Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, that was a thing that was on and off, has been on and off for, well, I kind of stepped away from that. When did I step away? What year is it? 23. Last year, I guess. So, yeah. Fall of 2021, I kind of stepped away from it for another opportunity that I kind of had that didn't really work out like it was, like I had hoped it would. And that's okay. Those things happen. But I, you know, I stepped away from Amy's thing based on this, and John Hammond has been doing it, and she had a long relationship with him too. You know, he and his brother have known those people forever, and it's all good. You know, we're all still friends, and I've known John forever too. So it's not like
Yeah.
You stole my gig. Well, first of all, nothing is your gig. If it ain't your band and you're not hiring the people, it ain't your gig. It's their gig.
See, that? This is what I'm saying. This kind of attitude and outlook, it's like, you just understand this from...
Nothing is your gig.
Right.
You work at the pleasure of the people who hire you. And that's not bad. It's not a bad thing, but it's reality. Yeah. And you have to work from that point. You have to work based in reality and just know, because otherwise you're just going to get bitter.
Yeah.
You know, because things change. You know, there were people that I've done huge records for, and they're still cutting, but they're not cutting with me. And it's like, well, okay, you know, you felt like you needed to do something else. I get it. I had no claim to this. You know, I wish you'd have called and said, hey, man, we're going to shake things up a little bit. And thanks. We've done good work. But even that, you know you did good work, because they were really successful records. So just appreciate that and go find the next thing. It's not worth festering, you know, bitterness over.
Did you go through that?
There's been a time or two where I've had to fight that off, yeah. In other settings, you know, not necessarily a lost recording entity or something like that, but just other things.
Because it's life, real life. Back to that. Yeah. This is real life stuff.
It's always it's just not worth wasting the energy over. Bitterness isn't. No. You know. Excuse me.
Of course. Like I said, hot day. You got to now. I mean, we jump around a lot here. I jump around a lot.
Well, I'm scattered anyway, so I'm appalling.
It works, right? It does work. By the way, are you still playing Slingerland drums primarily?
That's my main studio kit, is that big green kit.
Famous.
It's more famous than I am.
Like everyone's asked you about the green kid, right?
The green monster. That's what they call it around town.
Yeah.
Even the engineers. You bring in the green ones? Well,
of course I am. That's my thing.
But I do have a relationship with Gretsch. And Gretsch is a longstanding thing in my career. I think I got my first kit in 76. And, you know, that's always been a constant.
Right.
And so when the Seeger tour came up, it was a great opportunity to contact them and say, man, I'd really like to take, you know, a nice little Gretsch kit out on this tour, you know, and they were very amiable to that. And I don't require much. I'm fairly low maintenance.
What sizes do you prefer?
On that, it was just a 24, 13, 16. That's it.
Yeah. And what would have made the difference? Why would you have, say, choose, what other bass drum size would you choose, for example, on a tour?
Nothing.
Right, 24?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I do. That's just...
Yeah. Yeah, I got you. And the, and the Green Monster, are those the sizes?
Yeah, it's that's a 24, 14, 16.
Oh, okay.
It was at a time where Slingerland was just about to cease production. Henry Juskowitz still owned Gibson and Slingerland and their whole stable of brands, which he kind of successfully killed every one of them off, you know, Oberheim and Tobias and Opcode Software. And, you know, he bought all these trademarks and just let them die on the vine. And they were viable entities. And Slingerland was next. And Pat Foley was real good to me, and Sam Bacco. They were both still there when I started the relationship with them. I got my initial studio kit with them was a 22, 10, 13, 16 is what I was using. It had a 12 as well, so if I used a single rack, I used the 12 and the 16, and if I used two, I used the 10, the 13, 16, which is a Harry Stinson thing. And it's all in tonal spacing. you know, kind of equal increases in size. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. A 10, add 3,
and
13.
This is something Harry Stinson did, and you learned that from him, you're saying?
I knew he had done that. And it just made sense to me. It's like, if you're going to have a 13 and a 16, if you wanted to play a 12 and a 15 instead of a 12 and a 14.
Gotcha.
I can't ever really get my 14 comfortably low enough to have enough space between the two, really, for my taste, you know. But that's just a personal thing. Mm-hmm. You know, the drum catalogs always were 2012, 14, 22, 13, 16. That's just what you saw, you know.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that's become the legendary standard. But for me, if I'm going to play a single 12, I'd prefer to have a 15.
But you, like you said, the Green Monster gets most of the bulk of the work.
Yeah, see, I totally got off course.
No, it's fine. It's fine.
You set me up. You said I'm scattered, and I immediately scattered.
Who can go more scattered, you or me? Let's find out today.
Anyway, that was a color they called Coastal Coral in that first studio kit, the 22, 10, 13, 16. And I don't know. I went out there one day. For some reason, maybe just hanging out, or because, you know, I'm a drum nerd. I like to just to be in sawdust and all that stuff and see things being built and all that. Went out there and I saw that Seafoam Green. And I'm like, oh, man, that looks so good. You know, and it was just sitting on a shelf, you know. It was they had it listed in their catalog. The model of the kit was called a Rolling Bomber, I think is what they called it. Like the, you know, yeah, the takeoff on the... Yeah. Slingerland thing. And it was a 16 by 24, an 11 by 14, a 16 by 16, and a 16 by 18. And a 6.5 snare. And so I don't know how the topic came up, but it wound up coming home with me. And I just kind of had it for a little while. And then I got a call to do a Montgomery Gentry record, my town. And I knew it was going to be a pretty rowdy record. So I thought, well, I'm going to take the big drums and see what they do, you know. And so I got them out prior to the session, kind of started messing with them and I, you know, put my head selection on them and all that stuff and dialed them up. And I'm not sure about this. And the Studio Kings at the time all came with die-cast tubes. They just sounded clamped down somehow or another. And I know how to deal with die-cast tubes from Gretsch stuff. You know, it's not always that way. Anyway, I wound up going out to WorldMax and getting some of the... They have a kind of a remake of the Slingerland Stick Saver Hoop, you know, that's curled in. And I grabbed a set of those and put on those drums, and all of a sudden it's like the sun came out. That was just like, oh, wow, okay. So I took them in the studio, and that was the first record I ever used them on, and it had been on every record since then. Yeah.
Do you put anything in the kick drum?
A little bit. It's basically, you know, when you go in the hospital and they have those little squishy cotton-filled pillows that get really flat.
Yeah.
You know, I always bring them home, you know. I have a propensity for kidney stones, so I have a chance to accumulate numerous of those pillows. But that's what I use, because it just kind of gets flat enough. It doesn't take up, you know, it doesn't do a lot, but it just does just enough.
Is it touching head to head?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And how many do you use?
Just one.
Just one. Yeah. Interesting. And you have a lot of those pillows anyway, you're saying.
I do by now.
And I like how you take them home and no one else can have that secret ingredient.
Well, they're just going to throw them away.
Right.
Yeah, they're not going to reuse them.
And what about, what do you use for dampening on the heads, on the toms?
It varies. Sometimes nothing.
Right. And I mean, assuming like, sometimes they're wide open. But when you do, what's the go-to? What do you use?
I just have a roll of gaff tape and some paper towel handy.
Gotcha.
And just...
So it's a fold-up paper towel seasoned, tape over it.
Yeah, seasoned to taste. Yeah, or, you know, or the Larry London fin, the radiator fin, you know, where you take a piece of duct tape and in the middle of it.
In the middle, it's sticking up. Right, yeah. You're right, gotcha. I got the Larry London
and
fin.
People see that and they think, that's not going to do anything. And you just take it off and it's like, oh, man, did a lot.
Actually, let's take a moment and actually, what have you tried the difference between the fin and no fin? Like, do you really hear a huge difference?
Oh, yeah.
You do?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Yeah.
Try this at home, guys.
Yeah.
Anyone listening?
It does. And he would always do, most of the time, whenever I saw Larry, and it was mostly on his concert time kits, he would do three. He would do like a one at noon, one at seven or eight, and one at four, you know, like okay. a triangle in the head.
Yeah. And do you do that?
It depends, just case to case.
Okay.
Most of the time I get away with just one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, over and where, how far close to the edge or towards the center you put it changes it, and
mm-hmm.
you know.
So you're not a wallet guy on the snare, for example.
No, I'm not.
Mm-hmm. More tape on the snare, even.
Same method. Yeah, the paper towel.
Do you have a go-to snare?
Well, I change them a lot, but I think the first one that's always up is probably a mid to late 90s chrome over brass Superfine, you know,
6.5.
Yeah, it's a 6.5. But I use brass hoops on it. Just for some reason, I like what it does and it looks cool.
Yeah. Nice and heavy.
But no, it's a good stick sound, and you know, the rim shot is, not quite so metallic sounding. I mean, when you're digging in and whacking it, you know, it's a little more palatable.
But you like the side stick on that, on the brass?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
I think it's a little warmer.
That's a go-to snare right
Not
there.
Yeah.
That's Superphonic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the first one out all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, song to song, it just depends on the level of aggression or non-aggression. You know, if it's a really tender thing, or if it's a really kind of artsy thing, or
yeah,
you know, you have to cover a lot of ground.
Sure.
So
sure.
I take a number of snares to a date, and they all have a purpose. You know, they're each of them are tuned for what they do, and I don't really ever change them. You know, if I need X, I know this is X drum. Mm-hmm. If I need Y, this is Y drum. You know, same with cymbals. I take a bunch of cymbals. Those things, in the atmosphere of a track, change the soundscape more than anything. You know, the cymbals and the snare, to me, they do.
Yeah.
Because they're the most constant thing you're playing.
Yeah, that makes sense. And what about size of the hi-hats? Does that change for you?
Not so much. Mainly with hi-hats, I just want something that's not going to take up all the space. You know,
so what size do you?
They're 14s. They're just 14s.
All yours.
But they're a little bit on the lighter side, you know, because once again, hi-hats can just eat up a snare drum mic. You know, it's right there. So that, and there, you know, there's a technical aspect of it too, just kind of learning how to back off the right hand and not back off the left hand, you know. To you have to be able to mix yourself on some level. That's what makes it good for an engineer. When the drummer can balance himself on the kit, everything is much more musical. You don't have to hit everything as hard as you can all the time. You're not creating more sound.
Right.
You know, you're certainly not creating more tone. You're largely beating the tone out of stuff. It can only respond so much. It's like guys that club hand an acoustic guitar. You know, it's only going to give you so much. And then you got racket. Then it's just racket.
Do you have a light touch when you're recording?
I don't.
Or it depends.
It's funny because I don't think it sounds like a light touch. And I don't. I don't waste a lot of motion, you know, but I don't think there's a lack of power there. You know, I just think the power comes from my elbows down. So you don't see a lot of you know,
he's raising his arm
coming from behind the head stuff. You know, it's all, to me, it's all very internal, compact. It's compact, like a good hitter in baseball. The swing is compact. You know, things like that. You can generate a lot of power. You can generate a lot of power in 6 or 8 inches that's going to give you a great sound, as opposed to, you know, 2.5 feet from behind your head, you know, that you're going to be worn out after playing one pass. You know, it's just kind of wasted energy to me.
Yeah, yeah. Makes sense.
That's just me.
You mentioned Larry London.
Mm-hmm.
But you also, I mean, just help me out here, because I know you mentioned you got here in 96.
98.
Sorry, 98. And,
oh, no, you're right, 96. It was 96.
Okay, I thought you did say 96, but okay, yeah. And that's after Larry London passed away.
Mm-hmm.
So let's back up, because I know you said you saw him and everything. So
oh, yeah.
Let's get into, like, how does that all work out?
The very first time I ever saw him, I was maybe 13 or 14. And he came to Memphis to do a drum clinic at a music store that I frequented a lot called Melody Music Shop. It's where I got my very first pro level kit. And they were always really good to me. You know, they just kind of adopted me as the little Saturday nephew that would come in. Mom would drop me off when it opened and pick me up when they closed, and just let me hang there all day. And they were really nice to me. Anyway, the drum guy said, "Man, you need to come see this drum clinic." I said, "What's a drum clinic?" And he said, "Well, this guy's going to play, and you really should come see him." And I thought, well, okay. So I go, and they've got him set up upstairs in the combo room, and it's, you know, a double bass. It was a Pearl wood fiberglass kit, and it was right when Pearl was making that jump from a department store line to a music store line. You know what I mean? And Larry was kind of their flagship guy during that time. Anyway, the kit's up there, and it's double bass. I'm going, oh, man, this, you know. And the guy said, come around back behind the kit. And I went behind the kit, He said, "Put your foot on that pedal and try to push it down." And I noticed that the beater is all the way back, resting on the footboard, you know, and the spring is as absolutely as tight as it would go. I'm like, so I lift the beater up, get my foot under it, and it's like, I let it go, and that thing flaps back on my foot. It's like, damn, that hurt. Because he had wood beaters. And I play, you know, trying to play this thing, and it's like, what in the hell is going on here? Anyway, so he said, "Well, the clinic's about to start." And so I go out and kind of get my little chair, and I kind of look out the corner of my eye, and I see this really big guy coming out in a really loud Hawaiian shirt, you know, and like almost a pompadour hairdo at the time. And I'm just like, I'm not really commenting. I just, it seems odd. It's like, oh, this, I wonder.
Look at this guy kind of thing.
Yeah, this guy came to the clinic too. Yeah, you know, yeah.
Look at this guy coming in with the, yeah.
And so he walks right up to the stage and gets behind the kit. I'm like, okay. And man, he launched. And it was an onslaught like you'd never seen. And it was mind-blowing what he did and just how intense it was, you know. And it just blew my mind.
What do you remember? What stands out when you think back?
Just the power combined with the technical acumen. He was obviously, he just knew what he was doing. And the power... Once again, he wasn't hitting from behind his head. He's just a big guy. And there's force. If he just lets his arm fall on the snare drum, his sheer mass makes it sound. And, you know, maybe that's subconsciously where I kind of got that whole thing of just don't don't beat the sound out of the drums, you know. Anyway, so yeah, it was just, it was everything, you know. He just, like I said, the level of his skill level combined with just the sheer force of the sound was pretty stunning.
And it was big, I get what you said, just big.
Yeah, it was big.
And as have you to this day, when you think back to that, have you heard anyone in your life who can come close to that, that particular sound?
Well, yeah. Yeah.
Go ahead. Tell me.
I think Tommy Aldridge comes
close. Tommy Aldridge?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
This is the closest to Larry London.
Well, I mean, it was the same ilk. You know, the choice of what he was playing was not the same.
Sure.
But the power behind it and the skill level was.
Yeah.
I mean, Tommy at 21 or 22 years old when he did that first Black Oak record, man, he was bringing it. He was bringing it hard, you know. And I saw them probably 3 or 4 times. They would come through Memphis all the time, which is where I'm from. The Black Oaks just, it wasn't that far, you know, that they would come through all the time. And so, yeah, T.A., man, pretty damn mighty. And he's still mighty.
Yeah. Yeah. That guy, I mean.
Yeah.
He's unreal.
Yeah.
That's interesting, though, that you would equate. That's just interesting to me. That's all. Larry London and Tommy Aldridge. You wouldn't normally put those two together.
No, you wouldn't. But
yeah.
You can see the similarity.
Yes.
You know, based on, like I said, what Larry did. You know, this was his clinic thing.
Yeah.
This wasn't the thing he did in the studio. He was very song-driven. You know, he would just, you know, he knew what songs needed.
Yeah.
And that's what he did in the studio, you know. But when it came time to be Larry Dadgum London, you know, he unloaded both barrels.
I love that. And so, okay, so you got to see him live. This is perfect. Like, this is great. What an experience. You got to Larry, see it live. Yeah, you got to see it.
I'm saying that's amazing. And more than once. When I worked at the drum stand in Memphis with Dave Patrick, he's kind of my, you know, one of my early mentors and one of my best friends in the world. He was the drum shop guy there at Strings and Things in Memphis. And, you know, I was just the kid hanging around and I'd sweep the floor and, you know, just help with stuff. And eventually we kind of started doing custom work, you know, for different artists, different drummers, you know, building custom kits and stuff like that. We were one of the early guys to do Gret Shellbanks. And then we would customize what you wanted, how you wanted to mount them, blah, blah, blah. Because it was pre-rims, you know, there was no suspension mounts and all that stuff. So you could pick and choose what hardware you wanted and all that stuff. And we'd build them up, send them out. But anyway, Larry did a number of clinics for us at that shop. And we built a couple of Eames snare drums for him that he used a lot up here. Matter of fact, I've always been told, and I don't have any concrete evidence of this, but that, you know, that snare drum he played on O'Sherry was a 4x14 Eames that we built him.
Yeah, I can hear that. That sounds piccolo-ish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, anytime he would always come if we ever asked him to come and he never said no.
Interesting.
So he was around a lot.
Did you get to know him?
Cursory.
Go ahead. I mean, like,
you know, you're not gonna form. And a lot of that is a little bit of timidity, you know.
Well, what was the age difference
between me and Larry?
Mm-hmm.
Oh gosh, I would.
Because you said you were 13 when you first saw him. So would you?
First time
was
I
he in his 20s?
Him.
Was he?
No, he had to be in his 30s, I would think.
Okay.
Yeah.
So like double. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like twice your age. Yeah.
At that time.
Sorry, yeah, that doesn't stay with you, does it? You can't stay double age, yeah.
Yeah, I'm guessing he was 15, 16, 17 years older than me, something like that. I'm just guessing.
Yep. Okay, so you didn't really get to know him. Did he have was there a lot of myth surrounding him and a lot of...
No.
Okay.
Mm-mm.
Regular guy, kind of, I mean... Nothing. There was no crazy stories about him. It wasn't like that.
No.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Not that I'm aware of.
Yeah, ever. No, I was just curious. Like, you know, if there was a thing. Larry London, that large appetite for life, that kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. Well, you know, he studied martial arts. He had some kind of background in that. I'm not really. So you weren't going to trifle with him.
Interesting. Because he was a big guy.
He was a big guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, big guy.
Interesting. All right. Mm-hmm. But again, no time where he ever like gave you advice as far as working.
The best advice he ever gave me, he never really gave me directly. It was just his example of how he dealt with people in that position. You know, people that had come to see him or things like that. Just his, how he chose to deal with people and relate to people was telling to me, you know, because he could have been a dick if he'd wanted to be.
Yeah.
You know, or if he didn't care.
Well, you seem like someone clearly who's easygoing, and you give that off. You give off this kind of, like you said, you're sort of detached and like, hey, man, you know, just I'm easygoing and all. And this didn't seem to be something you had to really work on so much, is it? Like, that's just your personality.
I think it's kind of my nature, yeah. I think.
Yeah.
My dad was a pretty intense character, and it was a little bit scary at times.
Mm.
And, you know, and I think that kind of set me on a little course of, I don't want people to feel that from me, you know. And it was not anything weird. It was just, you know, you're faced with something, you make a choice of, do I want to be this or do I want to be that?
Yeah.
You know, and I just, for me, I'm much more comfortable this way. I'm just not a very confrontational guy, unless it's just demanded, you know, and sometimes you have to be, sometimes you just have to stand your ground and say, you know what, that's wrong. That's not what this should be. Mm-hmm. And if you want it to be that, that's fine, but I'm not going to participate, you know, and then you just walk away and leave it.
Have you done that on gigs?
I'm trying to think. Nothing's coming to mind.
Like you'll do the job. In other words, you're on a job, and even if you think like I'm not, and this is not what I would do, this is not the way I would handle it, and all that stuff, you're like, you know what? They're paying me. I'll finish, and then I'm out of here.
Yeah. There's that.
Yeah.
Now, there are things that I've chosen not to do.
Sure.
For those reasons. So I never did get to the point where I had to go in and confront the issue. I just didn't go. I just did, you know, I chose to not participate.
Is it people that you had worked with before and you had these experiences and you just thought, never again? So they called and you're like, no, I know you. No. Is it like that?
Occasionally, yeah.
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 And sometimes is it you get...
And but I always just politely say, man, I'm sorry, I just can't. You know,
sure, I'm busy, right?
It's not.
You don't have to tell them why.
Yeah.
No.
Pointless.
What is that going to do?
Nothing.
Exactly.
What it's going to do is they're going to go tell other people, that son of a bitch, can you believe he's, you know, that's what it's going to do.
Yeah. Have you ever suffered from what's known as imposter syndrome? Do you know what that is?
No.
Have you ever felt like on a gig, like, I'm not good enough for this, and they're going to find out?
I have, yes, but I've copped to it immediately. I don't ever, if it's something I know is out of my element, I tell them right then. It's like, man, I'm sorry. This is something so totally out of my wheelhouse that I'm wasting your time if we even try this.
What would be an example?
Anything jazz.
So that you get called in on a session and they're like, hey, it's this jazz thing, and then you're like, whoa, buddy. Like,
well, I always tell them that, and pretty much inevitably they say, well, just take a shot, you know. And it's like, oh, I'll do the best I can. You know, I will, my limited vocabulary in this genre, you know, I'll do the best I can.
And can you? I mean, do you feel like you can? I mean,
I don't know that. I don't have that answer.
It's not for you to decide. It's for them to decide.
No, it's not for me to decide. Yeah, if they wind up using it, it evidently was good enough. But
is there another genre that would throw you? And you said, no. Would you play metal?
I have.
Can you do double kick?
I have. I don't enjoy it. I, you know, there's a line for me between heavy rock and metal, you know, I don't think I would take a real metal session once again, because I don't relate to it, you know, on really kind of any level, and that's okay. But something really hard rock, I do relate to.
Kind of AC/DC vibe.
Well, or even Deep Purple, or
there you go, Grand, you know, Funk, that,
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, that kind of thing.
The Zeppelin thing, like that.
Yeah.
That, yeah. Mm-hmm. Driving power.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Different ball game.
Do you like country music?
I do. I do. I like. I grew up exposed to a lot of it with my grandparents and stuff like that. And in Memphis, you know, on weekends, just like there was pretty much anywhere down south, there was always country music shows, local country music shows, variety shows on TV on the weekends. You just watched them, you know. And, you know, some of my early records were Flat and Scruggs Things and Pearl, 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 oh, won't you be my girl? You know, those kind of things. I still have that 45 somewhere. So, you know, the country I grew up on was, you know, what they would say. Today they would call it, oh, that's real country, you know. Mm-hmm. But people don't really think about it that, I mean, all through those earlier years and in the 60s and 70s, you know, people decry now, oh, you know, country's just bad pop, blah, blah, blah. Well, but the country always had a pop element. What do you think Harper Valley PTA was? It was a pop hit. You know, it was an AM radio pop hit. A lot of that uptown country, they would call it. I think Owen Bradley, that Patsy Cline stuff that was very orchestral and you know, big arrangements and stuff like that. It was not, those were kind of pop records. They were very Sinatra-esque, except for her voice, you know, and the lyric. But the approach was that, was, you know, was not, you know what I'm saying?
It's big budget.
Yeah, I'm
stuff.
Just saying.
This is.
There's always been that cross-pollinization element in the country genre, you know. It's always had it wasn't always just banjos and fiddles.
Well, I mean, when you go into a session, a studio with a guy, I mean, is the assumption, we're here to make a hit? Is that the assumption that you think that they're, well, look, we're trying to get on the radio here?
Yeah, that's always what they're doing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And for better or for worse, that dictates a lot of the sameness of a lot of what goes on, because if this was a hit, then this will be a hit, because they're exactly like
totally,
this.
Totally formula, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then that runs its course, and then you stumble into the next thing, and then you do 20 versions of that.
Do you think in BPMs?
Not hard BPMs.
Range?
Yeah, because it's all based on the vocal cadence. When the words flow, that's the tempo.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, just listen to the singer. You know, if he's struggling to get the words in, the song's too damn fast. You know, if you're falling asleep.
Unless it's I've been everywhere, right? Yeah. There's exceptions, right? Exceptions to the rule. But I guess, that's an interesting point. If they're struggling, it's too fast.
Yeah.
So is that on you? Do you say, hey,
well,
to the producer? I think...
You hope the producer notices.
But if not, do you say, hey, I think we should...
Someone will. The guys on the floor, their only interest is really trying to make this... And it's across the board on the studio floor at every chair. You know, everybody just wants this to be the best it can be. So you never let an obvious thing just go. If they say no, then you let it go and you do that. But it's never wrong. Of course, it's all an approach. It's like, man, could we just try this just, you know, a beat and a half down, you know, just to see. It really just sounds like this is all just crammed together, you know, and you hope the guy will say, yeah, man, you know, let's try it, you know. But a good producer is listening to that very thing. You know, he's listening to the full picture, and he understands the full picture. And so, yeah, he's the one likely to say, you know what, we're two beats too quick. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, he knows how important tempo is. And he might say, man, this feels good where it's at, but you know what? Can we just try it a couple up or one up just to see? Because if it gives it that little extra edge without ruining things, he's going to take it.
Right.
You know?
Right. So when you're in a store, you're in the supermarket, you're in the car, whatever it is, you're at the airport, you know, a song comes on and it's like, well, that's me.
It happens occasionally.
Right? Yeah. Of course it happens. You can't escape that, right? You can't escape.
Well, no. And it's a point of pride.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like you're walking down through the airport or, hey, that's me. That's me.
But you know.
Well, but I know.
But you know.
And, it, you know, you'll smile about it because it's like, oh, yeah, I remember that. That was a good one.
Do you remember them all?
I remember a lot of them.
You think there's a lot of times also where it comes on, it's on, and you're thinking, could be me.
Yeah.
Don't know.
Could be. Yeah.
Sounds kind of familiar.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
There are those times.
Yeah, I bet. What are some of the biggest, that you just off the top of your head, when you think of like, that you ones you couldn't escape, that just all of a sudden this song was just everywhere, and you're like, oh, that was me.
Well, the Strawberry Wine was the first one. Tina Carter cut.
Yeah.
Because it was a very unusual song to begin with, you know. And she delivered it so big, you know, she really delivered that song. And it was a big kind of, you know, 6/8, slow 6/8, you know, essentially kind of a soul ballad, you know. And it was pushing 5 minutes, which was everything about it deemed it should have never been a hit. And it was huge because it pulled that chain for people. You know, it's like, oh yeah, I remember those days. You know, it was it's compelling. You know, it's just a compelling record.
Yeah.
And that was really the very first mainstream Nashville successful thing I ever did was that. And I remember it very vividly because I walked into Emerald Studios, didn't know a soul there, had never worked with any of these guys, which were the LA Joe Chimay and John Hobbs and Biff, well, those two were from Los Angeles, and Biff Watson and Brent Rowan, Dan Dugmore, and I think Larry Franklin played fiddle on it. But I had never really met any of them. And they didn't know me from Adam. You know, I'm sure I was not the guy they were expecting to show up. They probably knew a little bit out, hey, we're going to try this new drummer, you know.
Right.
We're just going to try it, see what happens, you know.
Was the producer who gave you the shot?
It was the producer's production assistant that convinced him to give me a shot.
See,
Lauren Cook was her name. Yeah, because he was new to town too, Chris Farron at the time. He was just kind of making his mark in Nashville. He had done a number of things in Los Angeles with Boy Howdy, that band, and had some success with them. But he had moved to town and was, you know, he was intent on making his mark, which he did. And he was always really good to me. Very successful guy. So, you know, we were a little bit in the same boat, but not really. You know, I was really the unknown quantity.
Yeah.
You know. And you know, they did not give me the stink eye or anything. You know, we just, they let us go out there and we counted it off and I just dove in and played. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it took long for them to realize I wasn't going to blow the session up. You know, I was not going to cause us to not get what we needed or, yeah. you know, make things not as good as they thought they should be, you know, that I could, you know, I could handle the job, I guess is what I'm saying. You know, but I didn't go in there beating my chest saying, hey, y'all just watch this, you know. There's a level of deference you got to have.
Yeah.
You know, everybody deserves respect on some level on a date. You know, you're all there together. And, you know, you got to give a guy a chance.
Have you ever gotten a chance to compare notes with, you know, guys like Jim Keltner or Steve Jordan or, you know, just...
You know, I've never met either of them. And I would love to. But I just don't know how the opportunity would present itself.
Right, right.
Because Keltner, you know, obviously, Mad Dogs and Englishmen was a very formative record for me in my youth, and it was he and Jim Gordon.
I would say, isn't Jim Gordon another one of your...
Mm-hmm. Well, that record was my first exposure to him. And so as a kid, I think that record came out when I was 12, maybe. And, you know, you don't really have a full understanding of what you're hearing. Once again, it's just like the rock and roll intro. You don't have a, on some level, you don't really have a full understanding of what you're hearing. And so when I would play along with Mad Dogs and Eastman, I was trying to sound like both of them at the same time, you know, because they're both playing. So I'm like, you know, I'm playing Keltner's part some of the time and I'm playing Gordon's part some of the time all at the same time, you know, just trying to make it sound that big. And of course it wasn't successful, but you know what I'm saying? You hear that and you're just trying to learn. And sometimes it turns into something else, you know, altogether. But yeah.
Do you have any favorites? Like, in other words, I mean, are you a Hal Blaine guy? Like, do you have guys when, as you became more of a studio guy, were you looking into other studio guys and paying attention?
Mm-mm.
Not really. Just doing your own thing.
No, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't recall consciously...
thinking about it.
Because for me, it's just playing a song.
Right.
You either know how to present songs or you don't. You know, you know what I'm saying?
I mean, in other words, you mentioned Bobby Graham. Like, are you just thinking back to that kind of stuff where you're like, hey, look, that's how you play a song, man. It's just that simple. Like,
well, yeah, of course. I mean, because all of those bands, they were all song-driven.
Well, yeah, right. That's what you're saying, though. Yeah. You're saying it's all about playing
it's
a song.
It's just playing a song. Yeah.
Right.
Presenting it. And for me, that's... That's an ability... I don't know if it's learned or innate. I'm not really sure. Because people have kind of asked me that a lot fairly recently. It's like, well, when you're getting ready to cut something, what are you thinking about? Or how are you, you know, contemplating what you're going to do? And I had to think about it. It's like, well, okay, pay attention next time. You're in the control room and you're fixing to step out and go do a song. Pay attention and see if you can identify what's going on in your head. And the best analogy I can kind of come up with is like when the work tape starts or whatever it is, however it is they're showing us what we're going to do, you know, presenting the song to us in the control room before we go out. It's like a movie reel starts. And I see the picture of the song in my mind's eye, you know, it as they're playing whatever it is they're playing, what I'm going to do just appears behind it, in my mind, you know, or what I'm going to try. It just presents itself just as it's going, like that. And then, okay, let's go. So then we go out and that's what I try.
Because you're free of all stress. You're free of all tension in those moments, recording.
I'm not worried about it, no.
You're not thinking. It's a natural place for you to be.
I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, well, because you don't think about it.
I mean, I don't consciously, no, I don't.
Nothing makes you worried or tense, or you're never overthinking in those moments.
Ideally, yeah.
Right, like you mentioned baseball, like the hitter at the plate, just relaxed,
yeah,
ready, make your pitch.
I guess, yeah.
See, you know,
there's so much intangible about it, about this particular skill set in recording. You know, it is a different skill set, and especially it's a different skill set, and then it's yet a different skill set in Nashville, because Nashville works really fast. I mean, really fast. You know, in Los Angeles, those legendary stories of, yeah, we worked a week on the snare drum sound, and then we had to change the head and start again. You know?
Yeah.
No. In Nashville, I mean, the pace, a recording pace is historically, it has been what people would say very leisurely here, where it was basically a song, a session. Well, a session's only 3 hours. In Los Angeles, in the heyday, in the first 3 hours, you may get lunch ordered. You know what I'm saying? It's a different mindset. I'm not, you know, knocking that at all.
It is what it is.
I'm just saying it's a different...
It's interesting because it's almost such a more New York kind of thing to be like, come on, let's go. Time is money. Let's go. Let's go. But yet, it's Nashville.
Yeah. And it's never really...
And it's never that either. It is not let's go. Let's go. There is none of that.
No, it's just a given.
It's understood.
You know that you've got two sessions booked that day and you know what you're expected to get. And it used to be literally a session, a song. Well, now that budgets have changed and you know, as will happen, the corporate entities hand down edicts that, you know, we need to get more for less.
Yeah.
And so now in those two sessions where you used to get two songs, they may push for five.
Yeah.
You know, maybe.
Yeah.
So they might book two sessions in an hour of overtime or something like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, everybody always wants more for less. It's not, you know what I mean? It's just, that's the business angle of it, of literally everything. It's not hard and fast.
Because everything has to become business, unfortunately, it's the way it is. I get that. By the way, you've been around the business. I mean, you've seen it all. I mean, I'm sure you've seen a lot of, like, the drugs and the alcohol. That can be a part of things.
I've seen the results of it.
That's what, right. And did any of that ever become an issue for you in your career?
No,
never. You just never touched the stuff?
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, I might have a cocktail sometime in the evening. I don't even know why. Just sometimes it sounds good, you know. But no, I've never smoked pot or done any indulgent. What they call now recreational drugs. I mean, recreation was the Ferris wheel, you know, it was the swing set. That was recreation.
Right.
I never really thought of.
Well, what I'm curious though. Like, was that ever a thing in the time you've had in Nashville studio scene? Like, were there guys who? Well, that was like an open secret where you knew they were. Recreational using on the sessions, and it was just sort of like, yeah, it is.
You know,
he does his job, so who cares?
I gotta say, by the time I got here, all of that was being pretty well frowned upon, and if word got out someone was having those issues, you didn't see them for a while.
Mm.
So everybody was a little more on their best behavior, and just, you know, more sober about life in general, and realizing, you know what, that was just bullshit. We didn't need to be doing that, and you know, whatever. I know there were times where there were issues with some of that with some guys, and I don't know who they were.
And they're hiding it, perhaps during it.
I think there was a period where they weren't necessarily hiding it, especially drinking.
Right.
I think it probably wasn't. you could probably see a flask out on a session, you know, at times. But I don't know.
It wasn't the L.A. thing, as you mentioned, where it was like there's the cocaine budget. It wasn't, it's not that.
It was never that.
Right.
No, it was never that. And there was a time where some coke may have shown up at a session.
Right.
But it was not like, yeah, we're going to have, you know, a mayonnaise jar full of cocaine here at 12:30, you know, be ready. It was never, I don't think it was ever that. But I wasn't here to, mm-hmm. to know for sure. But just based on everything I've been told by people that I trust and respect, you know. It was the other thing, you know. Just occasionally, it might show up.
But. Sure, sure. What do you do to cut loose and get away from it? Like as far as you know, just off time. Like, do you have things you just?
That's a good question. I have a motorcycle and I ride that some. I have a fairly big yard that I mow. I mow the part that doesn't matter. You know, we have guys that do the part that's supposed to be pretty, but there's a whole big back section that's basically pasture land, and I mow that, and that's fun. I enjoy that. It makes me feel connected, you know, to my home, you know, to get out there and pay attention to the that. And but I, you know, I diddle a lot with drums. I still kind of fabricate and build stuff, and you know, something needs a bearing edge, I'll get my router table out and put an edge on something. Or, you know, if I take a hankering, I might build up a little three-piece kit and just see what happens, you know, for giggles. I do enjoy that. And that comes from all those years back at Strings and Things with Dave.
I was going to say, I want to ask you, actually, when it comes to the wood stuff, and I've been asking guys, like, the idea of, you know, like birch, naturally EQ'd for the studio, right?
I wouldn't know. I've never owned a birch kit.
Thank you. Thank you. Interesting.
I think the cold, hard truth is the thing that changes your sound more than anything is your head choice.
An Emperor to an Ambassador, that kind of thing. I don't know what you...
My thing lately, well, for the last good number of years, has been smooth white Emperors on top and smooth white Ambassadors on the bottom.
Interesting.
And I got that from Steve Turner, who's a great drummer from around, you know, he's from Florida, but he played with Dolly Parton for years and Glenn Campbell and did a bunch of records, a bunch of early Travis Tritt stuff. Really great drummer. And he called me to sub for him once on a demo session. I think he got a master, so he needed to find a sub for his demo session. And it was right after I got to town. He was, you know, good to me. And I went in and his kit was set up. So I just played his kit. And he had those heads on this AOC kit. And I remember playing them going, yeah, I'm kind of digging this. These sound kind of like, at the time I was a Coded Ambassador guy. But these had enough of the good tone of the Coded Ambassadors, but they had a little more substance to them. You know, a little more meat in the mid. Then the Ambassadors can be a little bit splashy sometimes to me, a little thin sounding, oddly enough, being a coated head. But compared to the smooth white Emperors, you know, there's a difference there.
And
longevity too. You know, I'd go through a lot more Ambassadors.
Well, sure, but you hear a big difference between coated and smooth.
Well, I hear a difference between coated Ambassadors and smooth white Emperors.
Well, I meant more like a smooth Emperor versus a coated Emperor. Like you hear.
Well, the smooth Emperor is not as dead as a coated Emperor.
Okay, so you get a little more ringy.
Just a little more tone.
Interesting.
Uh-huh.
Interesting.
A little more clarity, I guess you'd say. And they friggin' last forever for me on the green kit. I haven't changed those heads in at least 10 years. I may have changed those heads maybe twice since I've had them.
Wow.
Maybe.
And that, does that include the kick?
The kick's never been changed.
What's on the kick? What head?
Power Stroke 3.
Coated?
Smooth white.
Smooth white. Interesting.
Yeah. Those are great heads. I love them.
Yeah. No, I get it. So you're saying it's the heads. Like, because I was talking about Birch. I mean, because you know what I mean, though, right? Like, that was, they're marketed.
Oh, sure. Well, it's...
This is for the studio. Yeah. These are the recording customs, darling.
That's the business side of it.
That's what I'm saying. Have you ever seen them in a studio in Nashville?
What, Birch drums?
Well, or even the recording customs?
Oh, there are guys that use them, yeah.
But have you ever used
them? I've never used them.
just making a point, that's all.
I've never owned a kit that wasn't Maple.
Right.
I mean, honestly.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I tell you the thing. And it's not just the wood of the shell. It's just the inefficiency of the manufacturing process. But 60s Ludwigs absolutely have a sound. They have a sound. And it's, you know, the inconsistency of the bearing edge being really wide and the shell barely being round and, you know, all those things. And the, you know, the, when they would roll, this is the only way I can explain it. I've never confirmed that this is fact, but I don't see how it couldn't be fact. You know, when they would glue the finish on the flat wood before they would bend it. That's why that finish goes into the chafe joint like it does. You see what I'm saying?
Okay.
So they would glue the finish on, then bend the shell and tuck that in like you know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah,
finish go into the shell like that. That's the only way that could happen.
Yeah, see, you really know your building, though.
Well, you get obsessed about stuff. You know.
But by the way, though, you're saying 60s like would have a sound. Don't 50s Gretsch and 60s Gretsch and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, yeah.
Slingerlands.
But it's not due to the choice of wood they used. It's how that wood is processed. You know, the 50s and 60s Gretsches had the calf bearing edge that was, you know what I'm saying? It's that instead of a 30, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Instead of a sharp inside to outside cut, it was an outside to in soft roll, you know? And my contention was that was done back in the day when calf heads were the norm. And that's what was putting the collar on the head. When you put the head on the shell, that soft edge would put that collar on the head, you know, and let it seed. Because, you know, plastic heads weren't out at the time, and the plastic heads have that collar formed in them. You know, you know what I'm saying? They do that.
Yes.
Calf heads never really did that. Calf heads were just flat.
Gotcha.
And so, you know.
It was built for that.
I thought it was. I think it was. Once again, I don't have any definitive proof, but that makes sense to me. You know, something had to form that head.
So is it also mean like a bearing edge today should be more about what heads you're realistically using today?
I think the advent of Remo, you know, coming out with the Mylar head. Mm-hmm. Formed as it should be, as it should sit on the drum, allowed for a difference in that edge, you know, being smaller and less contact and all of that. I think that allowed for that.
Hmm.
I feel like it did. But, you know, the broadcasters that Gretsch are making now have that soft edge on them, you know, and it's a sound.
Yeah. It's a big difference. Those in the USA.
Yeah, the edge. I guess I should quantify that statement. Then the edge and because the edge is like the bridge of a guitar. That's the purpose it's serving. That's what the sound source is floating on. Is that edge? So how that edge treats the sound source is going to affect the sound source. You know.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Did you have a preference of what kind of bearing edge?
I like a little bit softer.
Rounded?
A little bit rounded, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And do you have a guy you ever bring stuff to?
I just do it myself.
That's right. What am I saying? You do it all yourself. Yeah. You don't need a guy. You are the guy. So do the guys bring it to you and say, hey, Greg, would you do me a favor?
If they ever ask, I'll...
You would do it?
Sure.
Are we putting that out here as a side business? Well, how about a side hustle? Contact Greg Moore.
Well,
no, you're too busy for that. I would say, you know, even I'm going to be no. You're too busy, Greg.
No, I'm not too busy, and I do enjoy it, and I wouldn't take it lightly. I would say, look, bring it out. Let's see what's going on, and you know, it's not. You can jimmy something up pretty bad if you make a mistake.
You worked on that solid snares, right? Those that
I helped them. Yeah, yeah. I went out and helped them assemble, I actually helped stuff wood in the molds and stuff like that occasionally, and mm-hmm. they were just towards the end of things. It was a very skeleton crew. Mainly, it was just Dave and Sharon and Paul Gabriel, and me when I would go out there, and Paul was the guy really kind of doing most of the fabrication work. Johnny was gone at the time, and so it was, you know, you had to put wood in the steamer, then you had to get it out and get it in the molds pretty quickly and let it set in those molds, and then you had to take them and put them in the pull the moisture out of them, you know, the kiln, I guess you'd say, you know, so they would hold form. You had to pull the moisture back out of them, and then, you know, start mm-hmm. inserting a reinforcing hoop and lathing them down, getting them smooth and round and all that. It's a lot of labor intensive.
Yeah, no, and I was, do you have any of those?
Oh, yeah, I do. All right.
You have a few?
I do, yeah.
Do you use them?
I do.
To this day, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Yeah. They're pretty special drums.
Oh, yeah. I don't know what the value would be on those if you want to put them on eBay, but not bad.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I've never really thought about it.
You don't sell drums, right? You don't?
I do sometimes.
Oh, you do? Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Well, that's right. Yeah, Miles McPherson told me you gave him a long time ago.
His very first kit.
Yeah, the Rogers.
Mm-hmm. Mojave Red Rogers Londoner.
That's right. That's right. Still, he's still using them. I just so you know.
No, I know.
Oh, okay.
I see Miles pretty regularly. You know,
okay.
I was in a band with his dad, with Amy, you know, for a good little while, and his dad's the one that asked me, he said, do you have a kit? Miles is, he thinks he wants to play drums. I'm like, well, yeah, I've got this nice little, I think I'd only paid $500 or $600 for it, and it was perfect. I mean, it was in really good shape.
He's still using it.
Yeah.
Hello.
Yeah.
That's how good, right? Cleveland.
No.
No, sorry.
Fullerton.
Fullerton.
It was because they're like from 72 or 3.
That's right.
The Mojave Red.
Yes. Yeah.
But it was still Swivomatic.
God, you really know. I'm sorry. It's great. It's great to see. Like, you really know your stuff.
You know, I've just always loved it.
Yeah.
I'll sit down sometimes up in my little cave, but up in my studio and get out some of my old catalog. And this is going to sound so...
You're looking at old porn. I love it.
Yeah, but... And then I'll smell it.
He's smelling
it. It's like, that's exactly when I took this out of the envelope when it came in the mail, you know, 55 years ago. That's exactly how it smells.
I love it.
But, you know...
You're geeking out with the best of them, man. I love it.
You can't tell me you haven't taken a Ludwig Tom and gone like that and compressed the heads and smelled that burst from the inside.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, of course. And it's very identifiable, as is Rogers, you know, as is Gretsch. They have there's a...
Yes, they do.
There's a smell.
Yes, there is.
It's especially with the Ludwigs, though.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fascinating, isn't it?
It is.
How are you doing on time, by the way? I know you had a...
I don't even know what time it is.
It's about 12:15.
See, I'm already a day off. I think it's Saturday.
Oh, right. I got you. Wait, and by the way, there's like the Nashville Drum Show this weekend. Do you mm-hmm. participate in any of that?
I went last year, yeah.
But what about this year?
Like, I'll probably go, yeah.
Yeah, just say hi.
But just supporting the cause, you know. That's a...
Right.
It's not a lot, you know what I mean, goes on, like you said, four drummers. You know, there's guitar shows here all the time. Or,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's nice to have something like that down here.
Yeah.
I last year, there wasn't a whole lot of vintage stuff there. And I wish it was a little more vintage-based, because that's what really yanks my chain.
Sure.
But whatever. Anybody that bothers to come, you know, I appreciate it.
Yeah. Do you have a large collection when you said that? Do you have Trixons? Do you have...
I have had Trixons.
Yeah.
I had a Trixon kit and a Vox kit.
Mm-hmm. Did you like those conical kicks?
I love the conicals, but not necessarily to play them. I just love the look.
Because someone was telling me, I forget, Ari Blank, who, like, the engineer loved it. Like, comes down to a 16, I think it was, right?
Does. Mm-hmm.
And they, do you ever try that in the studio? You ever use it?
No, I never took them. I don't have the kits anymore.
Gotcha.
I you know, those Trixons had those little Bakelite pedestals that the lugs mounted on. And when they start disintegrating, I just couldn't bear it. It's like, this is going to be an ongoing battle. And if someone wants these, I'm going to move them on to someone who can fight that battle, because I can't. And now, with the advent of 3D printing, it's like, I could probably take one of these pedestals and have 1,000 of them 3D printed.
Interesting point.
And someone should. It's like, because I can't imagine there's not a market for them.
Yeah.
Many of those kits that are out there. But to answer your question, I do have a collection. It's not anywhere... Well, it's not as large as it was. And it's certainly not as large as hardcore collectors. You know, Bunny probably has one of the most massive collections.
Have you ever been there?
I've never been to his barn, no. But I know him. He's a big Bobby Graham guy. He loves Bobby Graham.
Of course, yeah. Yeah. I mean, have you ever reached out to a younger drummer? Like, you've heard a guy or something like that, and you just went out of your way just to go find him and say, hey, man.
I have.
Yeah.
When I have been exposed to someone or witnessed them doing something, and I thought, oh, yeah, that's the thing.
Mm.
I tell them.
Mm-hmm. It must mean the world.
I don't know what it means, but it's something I feel like I should do. Because there were people in, you know, my youth that did that for me. You know, it's just encouragement. There's nothing hurts about that.
No, are you kidding me? Especially coming from someone so well respected.
Yeah, well, that's a hard thing for me to accept.
Yeah.
In my mind, I'm still 23 and trying.
Well, that's why I asked you about the whole, it's imposter syndrome. This idea, like, oh, they're going to find out. Oh, I don't belong here. Like, you still can struggle with some...
Not so much that, but I still have... It's just that mind thing. I still think about things like I did all those years ago. And I still approach things like that.
Hmm.
With that level of excitement and, you know, at least my perception is that I do that. Because it is exciting and it's fun.
Did it ever get boring? Did you ever go through a period of like, I'm tired of this?
No.
Yeah.
Never.
Yeah.
I mean, what's to not like? You can't. I said, my wife quotes me on this because it made her laugh one time. She said, she told me when I did go to work, she said, have a good day, honey. And I said, hey, I count to four and then I hit something. What could go wrong? And she laughs about that to this day. She'll quote that at me. And that's my attitude.
Yeah.
You know.
But it's back to that. You've had this attitude your whole... It's who you are.
I guess it is. Too late to change now.
Well, I mean, you notice that. You know, I asked what makes a good producer. What makes a good session guy?
Oh, boy. There's multiple levels to that. Temperament is a big thing. It's as big a thing as talent. Temperament is. Because if people can't get along with you, it's over. You know, if you can't play well with others, it ain't going to happen. I mean, I've never seen it really happen, you know, like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I have seen people that came in, you know, guns a blazing and really doing great, and next thing you know, you're not seeing them anymore. You know, you go, I wonder why. He just, you know,
rubbed some guys the wrong way.
Couldn't get along with him, you know.
Mm-hmm. You didn't personally see it, but that's what you heard.
Yeah,
because you were like, that guy was great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty rare, you know. If you've gotten there, you kind of know why. You better know why. But temperament and talent, you know, really, And I guess along with temperament comes patience. You know, sometimes you just have to just sit there and be quiet and let someone figure something out, you know. And don't noodle around, you know. Mm. Don't be out there when people are trying to get something done, showing them the new, you know, your version of how to play the crunch or something like that. Yeah.
Perfect example.
You know what I mean?
Perfect, yeah.
So,
yeah. Just put the sticks down and...
Yes, absolutely.
How about that? Just stop.
And you know, my big thing, my pet thing, and I started doing this out of concern, but I can't tell you how many second engineers have thanked me. When anytime one of them comes out on the studio, if I'm getting sounds, when they come out, I stop.
Right.
I just stop playing because they're there to adjust something. They don't need me pounding the snare drum in their ear. I'll just let them adjust it, and then I'll start playing again.
When they close the door.
Yeah.
Or
even other guys, even the other players on the session, if I'm getting sounds when they're coming in with their guitars and stuff like that, I'll stop and say, hey, you want to grab some phones and put them on? You know, I don't want to hear this any more than you do. You know?
Well, do you use protection?
No, nah, I just use regular closed ear heads.
Oh, I meant condoms, but... Ooh. Gotcha. No, but you don't use it. You don't use ear protection.
No.
Okay. No, I'm just curious. I mean, so you're not cranking it in the headphones?
It can get rocking.
Do you have any hearing loss?
Sure I do, yes.
I'm sure.
But I mean,
do you have ringing? Do you have constant?
I have some tinnitus. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess we all have that. Yeah.
Yeah. I've been sitting 2 feet above a snare drum since I was 7 years old. That's a lot of impact.
You just never thought about getting like the.
Probably not until it was way too late.
So even when you're doing live stuff, you're not wearing.
If I'm not using in-ear monitoring. I'm not wearing any protection, but also I don't like when I was out with Seeger, I didn't use in-ears.
Right.
But also, I mean, I really didn't get any drums in the monitors. I'm sitting right above the kit. I hear them. Oh, fine. Mm-hmm. You know, so I would just get in the monitors, literally the minimum I needed from everybody else just to have kind of a blend. You know, I never, you know, you see guys that have big folded horn cabinets and, you know, big stacks behind them for their monitors and then a wedge here and a wedge here. And that, you know, it's like, nah, I don't do that. Occasionally, especially if I'm using in-ears, I'll ask for a sub just to give it that presence. You know, just to give it a little bit of that low-end thump.
Feel it.
Yeah, just to feel it a little bit.
Yeah.
It's not very loud. It's just a physical thing. Mm-hmm. But I don't like those things you attach to the throne.
Thumper?
Yeah, whatever they are. I've never really taken to those.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I got you. Have there been gigs that you couldn't do, just scheduling something like that, you know, that you still think of and go, damn, I would have, maybe a tour, that kind of thing?
It's mainly records.
Yeah.
Jay Joyce's office called me a little while back to ask me about some dates for a new female artist he was going to work on, which I think turned out to be Lainey Wilson. And I was going to be in Europe at the time with Bonamassa. And I'm like, you know, damn it.
It still gets you.
It does because, you know, he everybody speaks so highly of him and how he is to work with. And I've never gotten to do that. You know, it would have been the first time I'd ever gotten to work with him.
I see.
And I really hate missing that. Having missed that, you know, that opportunity to do that, you know.
Who were some?
That's the most recent one.
Yeah, I got you. Who were some of the most memorable producers you've worked with?
Oh gosh, Norbert Putnam. It's not often you get in the studio with, you know, a guy once removed from Elvis, and you know, an originator of the Muscle Shoals thing. Norbert is amazing. He's just amazing.
Are you asking questions? Are you?
I just let him talk. He's very open. You know, he's very open.
He tells good stories?
Yeah, he tells great stories. He's got a good book you should get.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
And he's a great guy. He's just a great guy. He's very formidable in my decision to move up here.
Did you ever consider going to L.A.?
No.
Yeah.
No, I wouldn't have fit, you know, lifestyle-wise. I'm not a fit for that.
I mean, obviously, because you've spent time there. You've done it.
Oh, yeah.
And you've done studio stuff there.
A handful. Uh-huh. There was a guy named Ralph Shuckett, another great guy, and sadly he's passed now, but he was in the original Utopia band, you know, the three keyboard player Utopia band. He was one of the three keyboard players. And somehow or another, I really don't know how it happened, but he called me one day. This is when I still lived in Memphis. And he wanted me to come out and play on a Belinda Carlisle thing he was doing. So I packed up my crap. I packed up my drums and I took them to air freight to the airport and shipped them out there and went. And God, it was such a great experience. I met Rick DeFonso there, who was in a band called the A's. Great guy. We hit it off immediately. And we were cutting at American Recording, which was Bill Cooper and Richie Podler. And when I was coming up, you know, we never did finish the guys who were important to me. Well, Jerry Edmonton and Floyd Sneed from Steppenwolf and Three Dog Night were hugely important to me.
Right.
And that's where they worked.
Floyd Sneed.
Was American Recording. So I got to just bend Bill Cooper's ear constantly about them. And while I was out there, he called Floyd and had him come by the studio.
You got to meet Floyd.
It was the second time I met him, because they had Three Dog Night had reunited in the very early 80s for a minute, and they did a tour and they came to Memphis, and he came to the drum shop I was working at, and I'm like, dude, I cannot believe you're here. I just can't believe it. And you know, he was very gracious, and this was so pretentious of us. At the time, he was playing, I think, one of those Slingerland cutaway kits. You know what I'm talking about?
Cutaway.
Yeah, it was their version of the...
Oh, the radial, the North thing?
It was their version of that. What they did was they just literally cut out the front of the shell.
Yes, I do remember now.
He was playing a set of those, yeah, that he had gotten when he was playing with the Ohio Players for a minute. So we're like, dude, you know. We took him a pearl.
Fiberglass?
No. This was when they had just come out with the great Keller USA-made pearl, like the Doobies were playing at the time.
Oh.
I mean, the 8-ply Keller shell made here in Nashville, you know, the whole shooting match. And we took him basically his classic set, you know, two bass drums, four mounted, two floors, and took him down to the Orpheum, set him up for him. He used that kit that night. It was great.
You're like, you can't be using these other... No. Like, no.
What?
You were saying, like, you can't use these other ones. Like,
oh,
it was like, no, man. Just no. Wrong.
Well, I don't think we immediately went there. I think he was showing... He really was taken with that kit. We had it in the window or something.
Right.
And he really liked it.
Right.
And I think we just said, hey, well, you want to play it tonight? You know, because we knew what he was playing.
What I meant. Like, you knew what those cut out, and you were thinking, no, man.
That's, yeah, we weren't verbalizing that to him. But the opportunity arose where we could say, hey, well, you want to play them? Like, bring them down, man.
Let us help you.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, it would be our pleasure for you to play this tonight, because just we love you, you know. And he was great.
Yeah.
Anyway, what were we talking about before that?
Oh, man. I mean,
can't remember.
I told you I'm very scattered. And you said we're a very scattered gentleman.
Down the rabbit trail.
Well, you're a scattered gentleman. I'm just a scattered guy. I mean, I am all over the place. I know. Believe me. I did ask you, though. So no tours that...
I don't think...
You had to say no to.
Yeah, I don't think there's ever been something like that.
Okay.
was offered that I couldn't. That I couldn't do. Mm-hmm. It's all been having to miss a session mm-hmm. or a recording that mm-hmm. would have been great. But you know, if you're booked already,
yeah.
you know, there's nothing you can do really.
But what would be a dream gig? I'm just focusing on touring because I mean the session stuff. You know, I know stuff can come up in the meantime. Just touring. Let's put it out into the universe. Seriously, I mean it. Like you're putting it out today. Who, what call would you love to get?
Oh, see, now you're asking me to say stuff that are going to go, he's insane. That would never in a million years happen.
Go ahead. Let's do it.
I would love to at least take a shot at playing with the Stones.
I kind of was going to go there with you and say, would you like to get that call? There you go.
Just because Chuck Lavelle's an old friend of mine. He's an old friend. And I saw Charlie on his last tour, and one of our Seeger techs was teching for him, and you know I got to go back and stand behind the kit and see the Keith Moon stick bag and all that stuff. And
did you get to hit anything or
no? Uh-huh. And you know it's just you know friends will say stuff in passing, and I've had a couple of friends lately saying, Man, the Stones should call you. They should just call you.
Yeah.
And I'm like, dude, come on. That's not in a million years. That's not, you know.
Well.
It's not that I'm even on their radar. It's not, I'm not even on the planet, you know. So.
Well, we put it out into the universe. See what we just did? That's what we just did. But that's it. That would be the one. I get it, man. That's a good choice.
I would be so fired immediately because I'd say, okay, we're playing Satisfaction like this. Dun, 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 dun.
Yeah.
Out of here, mate.
It's got to be that. That's the way to do it.
Well, yeah, that's, you know. They've never played it any better than that.
No, I guess not.
That makes the statement. It's that that pounding, you know. That song needs that.
And I guess it's also with the tambourine on top of it, right? Dun, 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 dun. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's vital.
Yeah.
So wait a minute. That's a great pick. By the way, did you get to meet Charlie Watts when you did that?
I did not get to meet him.
Okay. Okay.
I sure didn't.
Okay. Yeah.
Some things you just don't ask.
Maybe it's better. I don't know. He's a nice guy. He wouldn't have been a bastard.
It's not even a matter of thinking that.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of, you know what, man? he's earned the respect of just... to be here and not be bothered.
Let the man just...
you know, I did get a pair of sticks.
I love how you're a bother, yeah. You have a pair of sticks.
I did get a pair of sticks.
Good, good, yeah.
From his tech.
Yeah.
He was a sweet guy.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that he let me come up there and get that close to that kid. It's
like,
oh my gosh, you know.
Conversely, you've had guys, artists, bands ask you to go on tour and you've just been like, can't do it.
Just very, very rarely. Mm-hmm. Very rarely. Mm-hmm. And mainly a good number of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that often. And not... you remember a band called Raging Slab?
Yes, I do.
That guy called me one time. And he was very—he was really nice, really nice guy. But he, you know, he needed someone to go out. And at the time, I didn't know a whole lot about him. But I was playing some pretty heavy stuff at the time, so I think I could have done it. But it may have been my daughter was so young that I didn't feel like it was kind of time to be traveling a bunch at the time. You know,
mm-hmm.
So I didn't do that.
That would have been an interesting fit.
I guess it would have, yeah, because they're hardcore Northeast, I think.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. But look at you. You were game. I like that. Back to that. You're like, you're pretty much game for anything.
Well,
like,
yeah. I mean, just beyond something that philosophically I couldn't relate to, or, you know.
Yeah.
Something that was just too dark. You know, too... spiritually dark.
Yeah.
And there are those things, you know.
Yeah.
They're,
yeah.
I'm not naive. You know, there are those things out there. That, and those people are just coming from a, a different place that I don't understand and I really don't want to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's that's their choice.
Mm-hmm.
They have freedom of choice. They have free will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's okay, you know.
Do you practice?
No.
It's okay.
But, I mean, I play a lot.
I know you do.
So, you know.
I was curious more if there's things like, are you working on things? And it's okay if you're not. I like your honesty if you're not. Just curious.
I would. If something ever came to mind that I wanted to try and then I realized I couldn't do it, I would work on it
mm-hmm.
until I could,
mm-hmm.
you know. But...
Is there one thing you wish you could do? Like, I wish I could do clean single strokes like Buddy Rich. Something. I don't know. I'm just...
In context to just kind of what my bag is, no.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I'm comfortable with what I offer,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I'm confident with what I offer, and I offer it because that's my outlook. That's just the way I see things and enjoy things, and I always just wanted to play the songs I liked and just play them right, you know. So
when was the last time you took a drum solo?
8 bars last night with another drummer.
Just last night.
Yeah.
I love it.
But
before that?
Never.
So I literally asked you that question the day after you did one.
Yeah. Well,
and other than that,
it was in Elizabeth Reed. So there's that 8 bar drum break at the end of Elizabeth Reed.
Right.
And so, right. you know, it was basically us just clowning around for 8 bars. And,
but other than that,
it's just a non-factor.
I know that feeling where you go, no, no, thanks.
I just
have you. Do they do that? They look at you like your turn, and you're like, no. If Joe Bonamassa said, "I want you to do a drum solo," would you just say like, "I'd rather not"? Would that be your
first?
I
think I told him before I ever played with them with him. In earnest, in other words, like for a tour, I said, "Dude, I just don't solo." And he was like, "Man, I'm so fine with that. That you know, that's okay."
I love that. Yeah. So that's an upfront thing, just so you
know.
Well,
it is, yeah, because I don't want to leave him hanging, and I don't want him to hang me. Him in general terms.
Yes, yes. I get
you
it.
Know what I'm saying.
I love it. You don't solo.
I just don't find anything engaging in it to me. I don't play drums, I play music. You know, I play songs. That's what I do. The other thing, it just doesn't hold any... I don't know.
I'm with you.
It's just never been in my vocabulary.
Doesn't turn you on. To even mm-hmm. if someone says, hey, watch this guy. It's like, yeah, good. Great.
No.
Mm-hmm. Do you like Vinny?
Caliuta?
Yeah.
He's an amazing
person. That's what I'm saying. So you can watch that stuff and be like, wow, just wow. But that's it, right? It's like, yeah, I don't want to do that. And we're not knocking Vinny. Don't worry.
No, not at all.
We're not knocking him.
I'm not knocking
him. It's incredible what he can do.
It is. Absolutely.
But I'm saying, you're capable of that. You watch it.
I don't live for those moments.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
I don't know. So,
when's the last time you rode your motorcycle, by the way?
About 3 weeks ago.
Okay.
A little too hot right now.
Yeah. I guess so.
A little too hot.
You ever go any long distances?
No, I don't have a good enough seat to go long distances.
It's like you need a good throne. You do.
Yeah. And I've actually, a buddy of mine that's a big motorcycle head, he used to race professionally, but he's also an amazing musician and one of my long-term friends. Yeah. I said, man, I got to get a better seat for this bike. And he immediately, call Sergeant Seats, you know, blah, 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 blah. They'll, you know, send them the base to the seat and they'll rebuild it and make it where you can sit in it longer than 100 miles.
Yeah. When's the last vacation you took?
Wow. Depends on what you call a vacation.
Ooh. Is this when we need to phone the wife and get her opinion? Is this a point of contention?
It's funny because we kind of almost had a little bit of that conversation the other night. See, my wife traveled for a living for a long time, too. She was a flight attendant.
Oh.
When you travel for a living, when you have time off, the last thing you want to do is travel. So, you know, a vacation for us is our daughter and son-in-law are in Florida right now for his residency down there. They're almost finished with it. But a vacation for us can be going down there for 4 days. That's, you know, it doesn't have to be going someplace and doing something,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Well, it can be going to a beach. Yeah. That's what I meant, like a Caribbean and just...
If that's the case, I think we went to 30A, but that's been 6 or 7 years ago.
Mm.
We spent a few days there. We have a friend that has a condominium there, and they, you know, allow us to use it sometimes. And it was nice. It was really nice. We were there for about a week, I think.
But I guess you said it, like your wife traveled for work. So it's like, I get it. So it's not a case of where she's like, honey, come on. When are you going to take a...
I think she's getting a little more of the itch now. She told me the other day, she just sent me a text out of blue. She said, I want to ride a donkey down the Grand Canyon.
Right.
She grew up with horses.
Right.
And I'm like, well, okay. So I think that will be the next thing we do, something like that. Once again, my buddy with the motorcycle seat, Rusty, he and his wife had gone out there a couple of times and done that. So he's a big planner. So I can just, Rusty, tell me what to do, you know, and he'll like, it's this and this and this, and you got to do this, blah, 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 and stay here and stay there and done. You know, he'll know exactly.
Well, how far ahead are you booked right now? Are you booked in November, for example? Do you have bookings?
I have stuff into October.
Mm-hmm. Is that normal for you? Like, how far, do you have a rule if you don't go farther ahead than...
I book anything that calls that a day is open, I book, period.
Okay, so if someone does book, say, 6 months from now, you'll put it in?
Absolutely.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter what it is. Mm-hmm. I, you know, demos, club gig, you know, just... I don't quantify any of that stuff, if that's the word. In other words, none of it holds more value than the next thing to me. It's just work.
Is it first come, first serve?
Generally. Now, if I have a demo on a day and, you know, Jay Joyce calls and says, I need you 4 days this week, and then one of them is that day. But that's we call that Nashville session poker. It's what that's called. Because it's a given, and the people that booked you on that demo, unless it's like the morning of, you know. Right.
And you're going to really leave them in a,
Yeah. But it's never that. You know, you always have a good handful of days to say, hey, man, I'm so sorry. And they understand that because most of them have been in that same position.
So you're honest. That's the key. You got to be honest about it, right? Is that part of the deal?
Oh, yes.
You have to be up front. Hey, man, I know I said, but... You have to tell them?
Yes, this is $5,000 more than what I'm going to make with you.
Right.
And you don't ever have to say that. They know that.
Gotcha.
You know, just, man, it's 4 days of Masters, and I'm sorry, but I need to ask to, you know,
mm-hmm.
pull the plug on that.
Mm-hmm.
I apologize.
Mm-hmm. But otherwise, they go in the book, as you said. Otherwise, sure, great. Demo, whatever. Club gig, whatever.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, because it's just, it's all playing. It's a chance to play and work and all that, you know. I don't overvalue my services.
Interesting. Yeah.
I mean, you know.
Yeah. You have your rate, right?
I mean, my rate is generally what someone's offering.
This is our budget. And okay, sure.
Pretty much. It's rare that someone comes to you and says, hey, man, blah, 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 but it's, you know, it's only $50, you know, and it's like, really, 2 days for $50, you got to, you know, listen, man, I'm sorry, I just can't, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't make the $50 an issue. I just say, I'm sorry, I can't do it.
Right. Right. Wow, man. Okay, listen, we're going to have to wrap this up, unfortunately,
okay.
But we're going to have to do a part two. I think.
Whatever you want. Yeah,
well, at some point, I mean, I will be back in town.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I'm here for the week. I'm doing this.
Good. Who else are you doing?
Oh, man. I'll tell you what. I promise I'm going to tell you when I turn this off, because if I...
Oh, okay.
If I start telling names, then it's not a surprise every week.
Yeah, sure.
I like it that way.
Well, this is going to be a surprise, because they're going to go, who?
Yeah, but I'm going to send it to the Rolling Stones people. So. You see, that's going to be the catch.
Oh, geez, the height of pretension.
He
thinks he can play with us.
Oh, I think everyone listening knows that would be a killer. Killer set.
Oh, my gosh.
I think a lot of us would just pay to hear that, actually. I mean,
Steve Jordan would have put my ass.
Well, you said you've never met him, right?
I've never met him.
You talked to him ever?
Mm-mm.
Okay.
The closest I ever came to meeting him was I rented him some hardware. I didn't rent it to him directly. He was coming to town to cut some stuff at Vince Gill's house. And he specifically wanted lightweight Ludwig 1400 stands. And he's right about this. That lightweight hardware, it makes you play the kit differently. You know what I mean? You can't just pound the kit with that hardware. It dictates your touch to the kit. He's right. And so he wanted that. And Drum Paradise didn't have any of it. And I have a crap load of it. So I took
them. They called you?
They called me and I just brought it to them.
Now, do they pay you for that?
I don't think I charged them. You know, because Harry's a great guy and we do stuff for each other all the time. And if I can ever help him out, I don't mind. Even if he charged them, I don't think I
took Harry is a great guy.
Yeah, I don't think I took any money. I'm like, dude, you make the money. Much as you do for me, I don't care.
Right. Did you set up your drums last night?
I did. Yeah.
You don't get to do that often, do you?
I do it more than you think.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
But you use cartage?
Well, for session stuff, if I'm not playing a house gig, yeah, it's always cartage. On rare occasions, someone will say, hey, man, I can't really pay that rate, but can I give you an extra $100 to bring a kit from home or something like that? And I'm like, well, yeah, you know, I'll do that, whatever.
Interesting.
Yeah. If there's not a house kit, but cartage is an issue, you know, I have stuff I can throw in the car and go.
When you have to lug drums, does that dictate what you bring? In other words, do you like lightweight? Do you like?
I always just bring what I think's appropriate.
Okay. You don't think about the weight of it. You don't think about that, the lugging it.
No, because I don't. The stuff I use is not gargantuan anyway.
I just meant like a 3-ply 20-inch as opposed to, you know.
If the 20-inch was appropriate for the gig, I would.
Do you ever use a 20-inch on a session?
When I first was coming to town, commuting from Memphis, I used a 20 a lot.
Was that because you were commuting and it was convenient? Yeah, he's nodding. So.
And it was so funny. The first time I brought it in, the guy was looking at it like, I'm like, dude, the mic don't know what size it is. Right. You know, just put the mic on it. If you're getting too much attack, pull it back a little bit.
Do you still feel the same way? I mean, about a 20?
Well, I think you can make that case in a lot of situations, you know.
I mean, could you make a 20 work in any situation in a studio?
If it were a crunch, yeah. I mean, if it were, this is what we got, we got to do this, then yeah, you make it work.
Mm-hmm. It's not your preference.
Not necessarily.
Right.
But once again, you do what you got to do. With bass drums, it's weird because people always think, I'll just tune the bass drum as low as I possibly can. Well, it's not going to sound like anything but that, you know, tick. That's all you're going to get. You're not going to get any tone if the heads are completely loose. You know, if you're tuning it down like that, you're not getting anything. So I can't tell you how many house kits I go in and like the back head's just gushy. It's like, you know, they've detuned this thing thinking they're getting the bass drum lower, but they're not getting anything, really. So I won't tell them, but I'll start bringing the head up where there's some tone there. It's like, what'd you do to the kick drum? Damn, that thing sounds great. I'm like, I tuned it. You know.
Do you like the resonant head higher or lower than the back?
I just like it sympathetic.
Sympathetic. And that goes for toms as well?
Generally, my bottom heads are going to be just slightly higher than the top for the resonance. But I'm not as pitch conscious as I am tone conscious, if that makes sense.
You're more tone conscious than... Yeah. I got you. You're tuned by ear, right?
Yeah.
I get it. Like you said, prefer...
The drum has a range, and you just find within that range what you want to work with. There's a higher end of the range, there's a lower end of the range. Tune it to what's appropriate for what you're doing, but in that range.
Well, so
it's only going to give you so much. You ain't going to make a 10 sound like a 14.
And that's back to that. I'm saying, so the kick drum, like, you've never had to use an 18 because it's just... Why?
Yeah, it's bebop. That's what you play on an 18.
Well, I didn't know if, you know, sometimes you just want, I guess, I don't know. I mean, some guys do that, right? You know that, right? Some drummers, when they're home studios, like, they'll trade it, they'll put the 18 in just for, because, I don't know, that's, you just never did.
Only if I really thought, I have used a 20 at home a number of times, but because the song called for it, because it was a surf tune or something like that, you know, it was something that, yeah, back in the day, it'd have been a 20 with a full front head on it and, you know, it'd be two mics on the kit. So that's what I do.
Interesting. Okay. You do it that way. I get it.
Yeah.
Cool. I like that.
I do tailor things.
Yeah.
To what I think is appropriate.
Yeah.
You know.
Interesting, man. Yeah.
All part of the service.
See, that's the problem. We could do 2 hours just geeking out on all these. That's what I'm saying. Like, it's like this stuff is just never ending. Like you said, it's the rabbit hole. You're obsessed.
Making it all up.
It was all bullshit.
Yeah, pretty much.
I lied to everything. Was a lie. You want, look, you asked me questions, I gave you answers. What do you care?
I'm just a quick thinker. I don't know.
I love it.
It's
man.
Been fun. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you had a good time.
Yeah.
I'm glad you did, man. I really appreciate you got to do this. And by the way, years in the making. You don't even know that.
No, I don't know that.
I started this show 11 years ago.
Oh, you told me that, yeah.
But I only do in person. I do not, well, there was one exception. But
That's the way it should be done, you know, because you don't always get everything in translation, you know, unless you read facial and,
Thank you.
Know what I mean? There's
Thank you.
A communication level.
And the Zoom thing and the fake. It's like recording.
I think everyone I've done has been in person. I think. I might have done one that wasn't.
Like a phone.
I did do one that wasn't in person.
Like a phoner kind of thing?
It was a Zoom thing.
Yeah.
It was a Zoom thing. But it might have been dictated by, you know, the...
Dr. Fauci?
Yeah. Anyway.
Look, Greg, you can't do it in person, Greg.
Yeah.
We're going to need you to do a Zoomer.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll leave it there.
Yeah, we'll leave it there.
Right tomorrow, man. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.